You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to begin this evening's events. I hope everyone was able to join us next door for refreshments. And I noticed actually some people have brought them in with them. So I mean, feel free if you didn't manage to get a refreshment to before they close it down to get one and come back in and join us. I'm Fiona Hill, the director of the Centre on the United States in Europe. And I am delighted that you've been able to join us here tonight for what is the seventh Raymond Aron lecture. As some of you will know, this lecture series was launched in 2004 when our Centre on the United States and Europe grew out of our programme on France, which was set up thanks to the efforts of Phil Gordon, who is now the Assistant Secretary for Europe at the Department of State. And as 2004 was sometime around the centennial of Raymond Aron's birth, there was a decision made to name a lecture series we'd been planning for some time in honour of this great scholar, writer and philosopher. And also to provide a forum for continuing our programme on France in a very meaningful way, and to be able to invite distinguished French and American scholars, practitioners and experts to come and address issues important to the two countries. And we certainly have an opportunity to do that this evening with the seventh Raymond Aron lecture and our distinguished speaker, François Bourguignon. Now, before I get into a proper introduction of the speakers, I'd also like to express thanks to the people who make this possible. As usual, there is always a benefactor standing behind the scenes, and in this case, it's the policy planning staff of the French Ministry, as well as our colleagues at the Embassy of France here in Washington, D.C. And 6 years ago, the lecture series was initiated with the backing of Gilles Andirani, who was then the director of the planning staff, and it continues today with Joseph Maillard as its current director, and we're just delighted. We have our colleagues here from the French Embassy, and I'd like to say again, thank you very much. Now, Raymond Aron was, of course, a multifaceted scholar. Most of us know him best for his theoretical work on war and peace, but he was very engaged as a political commentator. And he also maintained a remarkable expertise on economic issues. Now, last year, some of you who were here for the sixth lecture will remember that we had Jean Pisani-Ferry, the head of the Bruegel Institute in Brussels, and also a very distinguished French economist. And we decided that we would continue this year with the theme of the economy, given the fact that this is probably one of the most important issues in the transatlantic discussion right now in the wake of the economic crisis. It's also an important issue, particularly this year, because it's at the very top of the agenda for the French presidency of the G20, which just started in the past month. And France is going to be chairing the G20 through all of its series of debates and initiatives through 2011, and will also be hosting two summits, one in Deauville in June and the other in Cannes in November. I'm sure the Cannes summit will be very popular among not just economists. But in any case, President Sarkozy has already announced some of the objectives of this French presidency of the G20, and they include a very important focus on development, especially on the role of commodity prices and the increased effectiveness of development aid for the least developed countries. And we thought that this would then give us a good starting point for the lecture this year. And instead of having a French official simply give us a list of priorities for the G20, as interesting as, of course, that will be, we thought it would be extremely important to have the perspective of a leading French authority on these issues, and especially on the discussion of global development. And who better than François Bourguignon to give us a perspective on what the G20 and other multilateral institutions can do for development, especially as far as inequality is concerned. For those of you who know Monsieur Bourguignon, he was the chief economist of the World Bank in 2005 when the World Bank's annual World Development Report came out and concluded that inequality was the primary obstacle to global development, and that only social systems providing health and education to the poorest could tackle this problem. Now, 5 years later, after the financial and economic crisis has shaken the foundations of the global economy, we still have a lot to do, obviously, in this sphere. And inequality is obviously on the rise as a result of the financial crisis and continuing to act as a brake on growth and development. And this issue has remained at the top of François Bourguignon's work in recent years. He's currently the director of the Paris School of Economics and a professor of economics at the École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales. He first began his career studying statistics back at the French Grande École, Ancier, and he's continued throughout of his education to really expand upon his studies of mathematics and statistics. And in fact, he went on to earn a PhD that was awarded the Merritt Brown Award for the best thesis at the University of West Ontario in Canada. So he has very much a transatlantic experience in his education. He did his doctorate in economics at the University of Orléans in France, and in 75 came back again across the Atlantic, the further north than we are here, to become assistant professor at the University of Toronto. So he's a North American transatlanticist, which is, of course, even better than just being an American U.S. transatlanticist. Back in the late 70s, he returned to France. He's had a number of very distinguished positions at the main French Center for Strategic Research. And in 1988, he became the first director of a new entity, Delta, which brought together the research units of a number of leading French institutions. He's been the author of numerous books, 100 articles, more than 100 articles in leading journals. And then, as I mentioned, he became the chief economist of the World Bank in 2003, succeeding Nicholas Stern. And then he moved to his current position as the director of the Paris School of Economics in 2007. Now, just to add to the distinguished roster that we have tonight, we are also delighted that our own colleague, Kemal Dervish, the Vice President and Director of Global Economy and Development Program here at Brookings, will be able to join us as a discussant. Kemal is sitting here in the front row. Now, most of you also know of Kemal for his very distinguished career, both as a scholar and a practitioner. Until February of 2009, Kemal was in fact the executive head of the United Nations Development Programme and also chair of the United Nations Development Group. Before that, from 2001 to 2002, he was responsible for launching Turkey's successful recovery from the devastating financial crisis as Minister of Economic Affairs and the Treasury of Turkey. I wish, of course, that he could play the same role here in the United States. So fingers crossed, Kemal, that... your expertise in Turkey can also help us here. And before his tenure at the Ministry of Economic Affairs, Kemal had also had a 22-year career at the World Bank. And he was there for a period the Vice President for the Middle East and North Africa, and also Vice President for Poverty Reduction and Economic Management. And from the end of 2002 to 2005, Kemal was also a member of the Turkish Parliament. So as you can see, we have a vast array of experience here. And all of it necessitates, of course, me now getting out of the way and turning over to François Bourguignon. And we're very delighted to have you here. And I also have to make a note that François has tried extra hard to get here. Some of you will know that Europe is in the midst of an ice storm and Paris has been particularly hard hit. And I think François practically had to get on foot to the airport through Paris because the metro was frozen down. He sent his wife as the advance party, so we knew he had to come. And he had to take a flight very early this morning instead of yesterday to get here, and we just hope that he's feeling well, and we're just very pleased again that he could make it. François, thank you.
Thank you very much, Fiona, for this nice word. It's a real pleasure to be here. And first, I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me to give this lecture named after a very prestigious scholar. I also would like to thank them because by doing so, they gave me the opportunity or the occasion to reread, or very often to read, some work by Raymond Aron, which I didn't know, and I enjoyed that very, very much. At the same time, I persuaded myself that probably I was not the best speaker for to talk to give a Raymond Aron lecture, because as a matter of fact, there are not so much economics in his work. There is much more politics, much more history, much more philosophy than economics. What I was really very struck reading his work by two things. The first thing is that this man has an incredible lucidity about what was going on in the world in those years. I mean, he wrote very, very much in the 50s, 60s. He died, as it was just said, in the mid-80s. And in those days, in Europe, there was a lot of ideology going on. Many thinkers were really at the same time ideologists, and what is really the big strength of Raymond Aron was to have resisted that and to have been all his life of complete intellectual honesty. And there are not so many intellectuals with this kind of record. The second thing which struck me is the fact that his work is very much affected by the world where he lives, and this is a world which is out of two devastating wars. This is a world which is still engaged in a very acute Cold War, and this is really reflected in all his work. This is also a world where Marxism, or more exactly communism, is still very, very strong. And again, this is a dominant, plays a dominant role in his in his work. He died in the mid-80s, and because of that, he didn't see the end of the Cold War. He didn't see the dismantling of the Berlin or the Iron Wall. And he didn't see, and this is a little closer to my talk today, the new wave of globalization starting, which, as a matter of fact, would change many, many things. So while I was reading in particular some of his late op-eds in the French press, I was asking myself, but what would Raymond Aron had said about today's world in front of this globalization process going on? So this lecture is not really trying to answer the question for him, but certainly he would have considered the kind of evidence which I intend to present with very much care, and I'm sure that this would have influenced very much what he would have said. And as a matter of fact, revising his work, I found this fantastic quote in an essay which is called The Dawn of Universal History. And by that, I believe this is really that he already had in mind something like globalization. And the quote is the following: in a humanity in the way of unification, and this is really the translation in those days of globalization, inequality between nations takes on the significance that inequality between classes once had. The condition of the masses varies more from continent to continent and from country to country than ever before. At the same time, the awareness of inequality is spreading and resignation to poverty and fate is getting rarer. I really believe that most of the issues that we are dealing with today are in this quote by Raymond Aron, and this was written in 1961. And I really find this quite striking, and really I admire the anticipation that this scholar had. After that, to some extent, everything is being said, and maybe I don't have anything to add. What I would like to do is simply to put some flesh around this kind of argument, and as a matter of fact, to show that Raymond Aron was not completely right in expecting this increase in inequality that everybody is talking about today. Not exactly right. I mean, he was right in one way, but not in the other way. So I would like to get to the evidence that is available on some of the points that are mentioned in that quote, and then at the end of the talk to draw some lessons from that evidence. So this is the line of the argument that I will have. Global inequality, as a matter of fact, is falling. And this is an historical event in the sense that for a century and a half, inequality in the world has been increasing. Over the last 20 years, more or less, inequality is decreasing. And this is certainly something which is not in the quote that I just gave of Raymond Aron. A secondary important point is the fact that this process is taking place at a time where global growth is probably at its highest. So you cannot say that inequality is moving down, is going down, simply because there is a kind of slowdown in global growth. It is exactly the opposite. Yet, what I want to show is that in Aaron's concerns, some points are still present, but maybe in a different way. And in particular, there are two issues which I would like to focus on. One is whether behind this fall in global inequality, we don't have a category of countries which have some probability of staying behind the emerging countries which everybody has in mind and which definitely are in the process of catching up with rich countries in the world. So in that case, this means that part of the quote I just mentioned would be still valid, still relevant. And the second point on which I would like to focus is on the question of knowing whether the fact that between country inequality is falling, we should not take into account that within country inequality may be increasing. And this is the first part of Raymond Aron's quote, when he talked about inequality between nations and inequality between classes. It is really between country and within country. Today, these are more analytical concepts that people working in this area are used to manipulate. So my last questions, or my last questions, will really be on what can be done. I mean, if these are the issues, if these are the concerns, in this world of globalization, this world in way of unification, as Aaron put it, the issue is how to prevent those two phenomena, those two processes to take place, and how to avoid that this unification that is taking place in the whole world would stop because we would not be able to control those two tendencies that I just mentioned. So this is the line of the argument. And now let me first give some evidence on the beginning of the argument, and then I will conclude with some views about what are the policy implications or what the political implications are, and the kind of advice that I would like to give to Mr. Sarkozy, the new president of the G20. First, the turning point in global inequality. This is technical, but simply very quickly to show you what is behind the figure that I will show. To measure global inequality, we are combining two types of data. Data at the aggregate level, GDP per capita in countries. We might use consumption, we might use household income. Things are more or less the same. Here I'm using GDP per capita and standard population data. I don't want to advertise the World Bank products, but all this is coming from the World Development Indicators, which are now freely available on the World Bank site. So if people in the World Bank are there, they can thank me for the advertisement that I just did. Then you need purchasing power parities because you cannot use standard exchange rates. We know that they are not reflecting the actual purchasing power. When you get to India, you change your dollars into rupees. You can buy with those rupees much more than what you could buy with your dollar here in Washington. We have to take that into account. On the other hand, now we need also within-country distribution data. So we now have more and more in many countries data on income distribution which are coming from household surveys, which are basically giving you the mean income of the various deciles of the population relative to the national mean. And the data I'm using here are coming from the OECD. There is this very good work produced by the OECD lately, which is called, the title is Growing Unequal, and is really a view about the change in inequality in OECD countries since the mid-80s. And I'm using the World Bank, again, POFCAL database, where we have distribution data for many countries. Some countries will be missing, small countries in general, then I'm simply arbitrarily deciding that the distribution is similar in those countries as in neighboring countries, but this is really has no big impact on the final estimate. To show that there is a change in the evolution, I will combine this series between 89 and 2006. It is not a series. I did the computation only for 3 years, with a previous work that I've done with a historian colleague, Christian Morisson, which is about the evolution of the income distribution since the beginning of the 19th century. Of course, the analysis is not as sophisticated and as detailed. There were many countries which are present today in the world, which are in the United Nations, but which were not, which didn't exist back in the 19th century. So, of course, instead of working with 180 countries in this work, we work with not countries, 33 countries or groupings of countries. But we also show in that work that it is possible to, this is satisfactory. This is the evolution. So you have two series. This is starting in 1820, and the first series is the historical data in the reference I just mentioned. And then you have another series which we have a discontinuity. So discontinuity is due to the fact that we change the way in which we compute global inequality, more countries, a different purchasing power parity correction because new data are available, and because of that there is a jump in the global inequality that is being estimated with this kind of technique. The top curve, the blue curve, corresponds to the Gini coefficient, which is a very well-known index to describe inequality, which goes from 0 to 1. And the curve at the bottom, the brown curve, is another inequality measure, which is basically the ratio between the 20% the 20 richest people to the 20 poorest people in the world. In both cases, you can see that for practically a century and a half, inequality has been going up. It more or less plateaued around 1960 with some fluctuations, maybe still some increase, but at a much slower rate than before. And when you look at the change of series, when you look at the 20 last years, 89 to 2006, this is the second bit of the two curves. You see that this time there is a decline. And this is something which is very, very strong. This decline is not a decline. You can doubt about the data. You could say, okay, maybe there is some imprecision. I mean, this is very, very strong. And this shows that there is definitely something important going on. Now, this, at the same time, corresponds to a strong decrease in poverty in the world. This is a curve which describes the proportion of poor people using the standard international threshold of $1.25 in purchasing power parity per head and per day. And this is only for developing countries. And you can see that back in 1980, you had a little more than 50% of the those people in the European countries being poor, and today we are in at more or less 26-27%. By the way, this means that the Millennium Development Goal, which is to halve poverty by 2015, will certainly be reached at the global level. Behind that, we could also have represented the total number of poor people in the world. With this kind of decrease in the proportion of poor people, the number, absolute number of people, has also decreased. The last piece of evidence I want to show is this one. These two curves represent the growth rates of GDP per capita in two parts of the world. The red one is rich countries, high-income countries, and the blue one is the whole set of developing countries. What is quite remarkable on this chart is the fact that for many years, I mean, it starts in 1980, from 1980 to 2000, more or less, the curves are more or less similar. You have the same kind of shocks in the global economy, and the rate of growth of the rich world and the poor world are more or less the same. But at the turn of the century, you have this divergence taking place in terms of trend. You can see that the blue curve is definitely above the red curve, and by very, very much. If you could read the vertical axis, you would see that the difference between the two curves is something like 3, 4, 5 percentage points. So the difference is really big. And you have the same cycles in the two parts of the world, but the big difference, and this is what I call the decoupling of growth trend, and I didn't borrow this to Kemal Dervish, who has something very similar in one of his analyses. But this is something very important, which is the fact that there is no decoupling in cycles, but there is truly a decoupling in trends. And this is what is behind the drop in global inequality that we have just seen. To that evidence, which seems to be nice and going against the view that inequality is increasing, and many people believe that inequality is increasing because of globalization, then there are two caveats that wants to make. The first one is to realize that the reason why there is this drop in global inequality recently is because of the between inequality component. And to show that, here is a... No, it doesn't work. Okay. Yes, it works. Here is a decomposition of total inequality into two components. The inequality that is due to the inequality between countries, the fact that the mean income in two countries is not the same. Even if we assume that all people within a country have exactly the same level, there will be global inequality because countries don't have the same income. And this is the blue curve. The pink curve is the total inequality. And the yellow curve is a residual, which corresponds to the inequality that is due to the inequality existing within countries. And what we observe here is that definitely what is driving global inequality is definitely the between-country inequality. What is driving the historical increase, what is driving the recent fall of inequality is this between component. When we look at the within country inequality, we observe something which is yet interesting. There's this big drop taking place starting a little before the Second World War and continuing sometime after the Second World War. This is really the birth of the welfare state. This may also be fact that there are countries going to or adopting a communist regime. But you can see that this has stopped. This plateaued for some time. And now there is a slight increase in within-country inequality, which is worth stressing. I'll come back to that for the moment. But for the moment, you can see that this has almost no influence on global inequality. The dominant force is definitely the between-country inequality. Let me get back there too for the second caveat that I want to focus on. It is the fact that the kind of argument I just had is not shared by everybody. And we still hear people in public debates telling, how come can you tell us that global inequality has decreased? We observe that poor countries are getting poorer and rich countries are getting richer. And what is going on? I mean, how come do you get to that conclusion? Those people are not wrong. And I'll show you one evidence in favor of this view. In this chart here, the top curve, it could have been blue, it would have been better. The top curve is a curve that we had before. It is the evolution of global inequality, taking into account within country and between country inequality. The curve at the bottom is a curve of inequality where we consider all countries in the world, we ignore within-country inequality, but we don't weigh those countries by their population. In other words, we consider that China is the same or weighs the same thing as Luxembourg, and India the same thing as Dubai. Okay? Now, if you do that, and so if you look at the inequality measure here is the 10 richest over the 10% poorest. So if you have 140, 150 countries, this means that you're looking at the ratio between the mean income of the 15 richest countries over the mean income of the 15 poorest countries. And what you can see there, that inequality there has not declined. Meaning that, yes, I mean, there are problems in the sense that it is true that there are some poor countries which are not doing well. And the reason why global inequality in the top curve is decreasing recently is basically because those giant countries like India, like China, of course, and Brazil, or these kind of countries, are doing rather well. So it is important. I mean, this should not hide the fact that when we go to sub-Saharan Africa in particular, we will find some small countries which are not doing so well after all. Okay, let me now look at what we may expect for the coming 5 to 10 years and about the two inequality concerns that I mentioned right at the beginning. Let me try to substantiate these concerns. First, when we look, we'll go quickly on this. When we look at the outlook for the following 10 years, and several people have worked on this, it does not make, there is not very much doubt that developed countries will continue with a slow growth. There are many reasons for that. Public indebtedness, fiscal contraction, unemployment, new regulation of the financial sector, and the important fact, and I think that we don't insist in general enough on this, which is the fact that developed countries are facing a major restructuration process, which is due to the globalization process. Definitely there is a desindustrialization process going on in many parts of the world, and the part of the slow growth is due to that. So because of that, it is it would be surprising to see a very fast growth in those countries in the years to come. When we look at the big emerging countries, this is not true anymore. Why? Because those countries can rely on domestic markets, and they will increasingly do that. There is a big debate today at the international level about whether China will move toward a more inward-oriented development strategy. I don't know when this will take place, but one thing I know, I believe, is that this will take place at one point of time. Now, it may not be fast enough for many people in the rest of the world, but there are political constraints in China as in many other countries. And another reason why growth may be very quick in those countries is that there is a lot of scope for more south-south trade, and we already have seen that south-south trade is growing very fast, and this will continue. Now, those countries will also be affected by the fact that northern countries, rich countries, will not grow as fast as in the past. And even if there is this catching up, we have to remember that rich countries still weigh something between 55 and 70% of global GDP, depending on whether one is using PPP or not. But whatever the what we can think about this, it is most likely that the global equalizing in the world distribution will continue. But what about sub-Saharan Africa? What we observe today, that when we look at the evolution of the geographical composition of poverty combined with demographics, we observe, and economic growth, we observe that poverty in the world is more and more an African problem. Okay? And I'll show this to you here. On this chart, this is the same chart as before. You have the blue curve for all developing countries. You have the red curve for all the rich countries. But now you have a green curve for sub-Saharan Africa. And what you observe is that sub-Saharan Africa has done very, very badly during the 80s and during the 90s. This is what has been called the lost decades for development. They are doing much better over the recent years. This is starting in 2004, 2005. And then many people in Africa, in particular, in the African Development Bank, for example, believe that Africa is now on the same path as China, as India, etc. I think there is a lot of debate about this. Okay, there's something wrong in the way in which this, all this is working, but okay, that's fine. There is a debate on the cause for this growth, the resuming growth in Africa, whether it is structural, whether something has changed in Africa, and many people insist on the fact that the governance has much improved, that policies have much improved, etc., which is certainly true, or whether there is something cyclical, and in particular whether Africa today is not surfing on very high commodity prices. Now, if this is the case, then this surge in growth might be temporary, and there are conflicting influence of international environment in the future which may explain or which may cause commodity prices maybe not to fall too much, but to come back to a more reasonable level. And there is no escape to the fact that there is a need for diversification in Africa, which is, for the moment, not taking place at all. So to say that Africa is moving at the same time as all those big emerging countries, and this will be the case for the years to come, for the decades to come, I think this is going too fast. There is still a poor country problem in the world. There is still a sub-Saharan Africa problem in the world, and we cannot simply ignore that. The second concern, and evident about the second concern, which I mentioned at the beginning, is what is going on with within-country inequality, with domestic inequality, and isn't it the case that there is something going on in the world such that domestic inequality is in some way substituting global or between country inequality. What we observe is that over the last 20 years, in many countries, there has been a very substantial increase in inequality. When I look to the OECD countries, over the last 20 years, half of OECD countries have seen a substantial, significant increase in inequality. Of course, the U.S. is the most obvious case. Here you have a list of countries. Plus plus means that the Gini coefficient in those countries has increased by 2 percentage points at least. Plus means that the Gini coefficient has increased by 1 percentage point. But you can see that there are many plus-plus countries, and not only the United States and United Kingdom, which is a case which is very well known, but also Sweden, Finland, Norway, Germany, Italy. This is a big list. And France is a country where inequality has been extremely flat over the recent years, but we have signs that things are changing today, and that there is probably an increase in inequality that is taking place. Now, the issue that we have here is whether this is due to internal policies. And we know that in some countries it is the case. In Sweden, for example, we know that there has been political political changes such that the state is certainly much less progressive today than it was 20 years ago. But is it the only thing? And isn't it the case that even when we look at market incomes before redistribution, etc., isn't it the case that inequality is increasing? And if this is the case, then we know that in all these countries there is a tendency for people to say the reason why inequality is increasing is because of globalization, is because there are some people who are getting out of their job, who are fired from their job because of the restructuration of the economy. It is due to the fact that we have those top executives, those traders in the international financial market who are getting very high pay. This is a reflection of globalization. And because of that, we see that inequality is increasing in our countries. Now, of course, the U.S. case is completely dramatic. Here I simply put a table which is showing the change in the distribution in the U.S. between 1979 and 2004. When you look at the quintiles of the distribution, the 20% poorest, the next 20%, etc., the 20% poorest in the United States between 1979 and 2004 in real mean income has seen an increase equal to 6% in 25 years. When you look at the top 20% in the U.S., in the same 25 years, they have seen an increase in their real income, which is 70%. So the difference is absolutely enormous. If you look at the way in which the benefits from growth have been distributed in the U.S. during this period, you realize that the bottom 20% has obtained 1% of the total additional income which was generated during this period, whereas the top 20% has gotten 70% of the total additional income which has been generated. This is really something very, very important, very, very big. Now, the problem is to know whether, from that point of view, the U.S. is an exceptional case or whether the U.S. is a forerunner. And again, we may believe that there are forces in the globalization process, and this is something that economists have been studying a long time ago, and very oddly, they are not working anymore on this, assuming that this is the issue has been resolved, which is what is the impact, what is the role that globalization plays behind this kind of evolution. Also, we observe that in many developing countries, inequality has increased. It has increased in China. There are conflicting evidence, but people who have worked on the income distribution in India rather than the consumption distribution tend to believe that there is an increase in inequality in India, traditionally a very egalitarian country. And we observe an increase in inequality in countries like Vietnam, in Thailand, in Taiwan. The only exception from that point of view is in Latin America, where inequality was very high to start with. And it is true that over the last couple of years in Brazil, in Argentina, in Chile, there has been a decrease in inequality, very much linked to very strong redistribution policies. But this idea that behind the scene or behind those policies, globalization, or there are forces in many countries which contribute to an increase in within country inequality cannot be discarded. Now, what is worrying is that if this is the case, then behind those increases in inequality, we may have a very strong forces against what Raymond Aron was calling the humanity in unification, I mean, against the process of globalization. And this would be a serious threat on the process itself and on the benefits that this process can generate. This may be justified on economic grounds, or this may not be justified. It is simply the fact that people observe that there is more inequality. They observe at the same time that they are living in economies where big changes are taking place, and they are associating those two evolutions and saying one must be the cause of the other. If this is okay, then there is a threat here for the whole process to stop or to at least go much more slowly because of that. Now, I'm not saying, and maybe this is a point on which we would have to go back in the discussion, that globalization is necessarily good per se and for everybody in the world. Of course, we must have a much more nuanced view, but this is something which comes out of this kind of evidence that we have here. So let me conclude about the role of global governance in all this. I would say that the first thing, with concern number one, is that we should make sure that the poor countries in the world, and in particular those countries which are concentrated in sub-Saharan Africa, are not left behind. What does that mean? This means that development assistance cannot simply be dismantled, as many people today are suggesting. You have this now unfortunately well-known book by Dambisa Moyo on dead aid, where basically the suggestion is to get rid of aid. I don't think this is something possible. We have to agree on the fact that aid may not be always very effective, that there are big progresses to be made in the effectiveness of aid. But one thing we can observe is that if tomorrow we stop with development assistance, in many countries the educational sector is simply dead, the health sector is simply dead, and many infrastructure expenditures will not be met. So at this stage, considering that development assistance could be cut down in any substantial way is going completely against this concern number one of not leaving countries behind. We have to hope that at some stage those countries might become autonomous, and we have to do all for this to be possible, but for the moment it is certainly too early to consider this. Now, there is a problem, really, and the problem is again coming to some extent from globalization. What I can observe when I talk to donors in Europe and in my own country, when I talk to members of parliament in my own country about aid, everybody has in mind the competition coming from China. And everybody is telling me, look, but you want us to give money to multilateral organizations, but this means that our flag will disappear. We want our flag to appear everywhere because we see that the Chinese are getting a lot of benefits out of this, and we are not getting those benefits. And it is true that from that point of view, there is an issue, and globalization is generating some negative externalities in that community of donors. This is something that has to be thought about. Certainly, this is an issue that the G20 could be looking at, but this is not a reason for simply dropping or considering that development assistance is not important. This is not the only important part in the policies of developed countries with respect to Africa. Trade policies are extremely important. And for years, we have tried to open up our markets to African countries. The result is very disappointing. It is very disappointing simply because we only did it in a very restrictive way. And, if, for example, if we look at the case of Europe, this initiative, which was called Everything But Arms, which were opening up all markets in Europe except for arms, to the exports from least developed countries, this has not functioned very well. Why? Simply because this was coming with rules of origin which were which could not be met by many countries. So there is still a huge effort to be made in order to open up markets, and a lot to facilitate in those countries a diversification. It is very difficult to imagine that African development can take place jumping from an agricultural economy to a service economy or to simply a commodity exporting economy. They may be doing very well, but demographic pressure is such that those countries cannot do or cannot develop in the same way as Gulf countries, for example, have developed. So here, there is really a very important role to be played by global governance. The second part, of course, is to contain inequality within countries, whether these are developed countries or emerging countries. This can be done probably in different ways. Certainly more inward-oriented development strategy in emerging countries will probably generate a more equal process of development than a completely outward-oriented strategy. South-South trade is probably doing the same thing. And to the extent that the increase in inequality that is observed in those countries is due to globalization, it is possible that changing slightly, and maybe making more effective development strategies will modify this aspect. But there is also a need in most countries for more social protection and more redistribution at the country level. And this is becoming a true global issue. Why is that? Because we can see in many rich countries that there is a resistance toward the welfare state, toward maintaining the welfare state as it is, and in some cases try to make the welfare state still more powerful, basically because people are telling us, look, if we do that, we are becoming less competitive with respect to the rest of the world. So here we typically have a coordination problem. If many countries are not moving in that direction at the same time, then it is true that there will be free riding, and with free riding, nobody will really get into that direction, and we have the risk that the inequality increasing process that we observe in some countries will continue and will strengthen over time. So, again, it seems to me that this is an important dimension that has to be considered in the line of the basic argument that I took at the beginning from Raymond Aron. Now, unfortunately, I don't have the talent of Raymond Aron to write op-eds and to convince policymakers of the direction in which they should go, more politicians than policymakers, I should say. But there is a real need for that. And the G20... maybe the opportunity or maybe the instrument to have this kind of policies or this kind of concerns being expressed and being taken care of. I'm not, I must say, completely convinced that this will happen already this year. It is true that the French presidency reiterated the importance of development, but I was not very much impressed by what the Koreans said from that point of view. So if it is simply a matter of reiterating what was said and what is called now the Seoul consensus on development, I'm not sure that this will go very far. More has to be done, and a more energetic position has to be taken. On the other hand, I'm not completely clear on the fact that focusing on trying to repair or trying to improve the international monetary system, which seems to be more and more the main goal that Mr. Sarkozy is trying to will try to achieve with the G20, is very promising. And it seems to me that the two goals that I've expressed in this presentation are certainly as important as the monetary, international monetary system, but I'm sure that many people in the room are completely against this view. So better for me to stop at this stage. Thank you very much.
François, that was a really clear and I think not just informative but very compelling case that you made. And I know there's not a few but quite a lot of people who are trying to influence policymakers and politicians sitting in this room. I can see some of my Brookings colleagues right in front of me. And we also have one of our distinguished fellows, Javier Solana, who many of you will know from his various capacities sitting here in the front row. And I'm sure that a lot of people will be walking out of your presentation, especially when we've heard Kemal's remarks as well, thinking very hard about this and thinking ways that they can take some action. And Kemal, over to you. And then I'll invite you to join us here for a discussion with our audience.
Thank you very much, and thank you, François, for this wonderful overview, this wonderful lecture. It really was a pleasure to listen. One of the problems we have, of course, is that we agree on almost everything. So it's very hard to kind of argue with François, because first his facts are there, his analysis is concise, and on top of that, I agree with the approach. So that makes it a little bit hard. But let me say a few things, more to reinforce really what he said than anything else. I mean, for a student of development, for a development economist, for somebody who's interested in economic history, I mean, these things are essential. We sleep with them, we wake up, we dream of these numbers, and we kind of live with them. And you know, it is fantastically important. And I think one of the examples that is well known in among development economists, but I think is always so almost shocking, is that in the 1950s, early 1950s, Korea, the Republic of Korea, you know, was poorer than Ghana. And now, with PPP, it's about 12 times richer. And when we think that this happened in 50 years, basically, it's mind-boggling. I mean, it's within our lifetime. Our meaning somebody who was born in 49 in my case. But anyway, some of you were obviously weren't. But in 50 years, this can happen. So, you know, while per capita income shifts and things like that, of course, take time, when you think about it, cumulative growth differences of 3-4 percentage points, when they accumulate over a few decades, make a huge, huge difference. Now, of course, you know, UNDP, and one has to remember that per capita income is not everything. One has to look at life expectancy and health and education. But also in these indicators, we see the same kind of story. So these are amazing trends when you think about it. And François showed us that there has now been a historical decoupling in the trend growth rate of the developing countries as a whole, with some exceptions in sub-Saharan Africa. But recently that even maybe coming to the same. But, you know, that this decoupling is really historical. His first growth rates, and, you know, it's a graph that I also utilize very often. And I think one other thing that one can think of, I think, when we look at this, is, of course, have there been precedents? And Korea has been a precedent. Japan has been a precedent. I mean, Japan has really grown extremely rapidly after the Second World War and has closed the gap between which separated it from the traditional rich countries. But, you know, we were talking then of about 130 million people, roughly. If you just take China now, it's 1.3. I think if we make the mental experiment of reminding ourselves of the debates on Japan in the 1980s, I mean, think of what these debates would have been if Japan, instead of 130 million people, had been 1.3 billion people. And if we add India, which is having an extremely strong performance now, you know, we're now talking about 2.5 to 3 billion people. We're not talking of 130 million people. So in that sense, it's completely unprecedented. It's a completely new phenomenon, which we all, I think, have to come to grips with and adjust to. So I just wanted to reinforce these points, which are underlying François's projections and his presentation. Now, one thing François did not enter, and of course he only had 1 hour, but obviously the question comes up, why? I mean, why is it that this is happening? That, you know, it wasn't happening until about 20 years ago, and now it's happening. And there are many reasons, and obviously I don't have the time to go over all this analysis, and, you know, some of the reasons are not well understood, maybe. But going down to the basic, we have three basic things that determine per capita income. One is the proportion of people who are productively employed in the total population. It's very important. You know, how the age structure of the population. And here, the demographic transition in the emerging market and developing countries, of course, is a very important factor. The fact that the birth rate has gone down, population pressure has gone down, and that now many of these countries have a share of the active population that is much larger, and they're not aging yet either. So they're, in some sense, at the optimal point of their demography. That's one important point. Second, the amount of capital with which these workers work, capital accumulation. And here I want to come back. Overall, there is strong capital accumulation, although it's very unequal when we look at the developing countries as a whole. But there is a lot more capital that's being accumulated, much more investment in many of these emerging countries. In India, in China, it is well above 35 to 40% range, which is huge, compared to an investment rate of 20% in the advanced countries on average. Okay, so the fact that there is much more rapid investment and capital deepening is obviously a second important factor. Now, one of the things that a big debate is, you know, how strong are diminishing returns to capital? And I don't want to go into that, but it depends a lot on technology. So the third factor is that these countries are able to absorb a lot of existing technology very rapidly. And I do believe that the information revolution that occurred over the last three decades probably has allowed an importation and adaptation of capital at a much more rapid pace than was possible 30, 40 years ago. So in that sense, the catch-up growth that is based on capital import, technology adaptation and technology diffusion, thanks to the modern technology, is more rapid than it was decades ago. So I think if you take those three factors, more investment, more rapid diffusion of technology, and a better demography for most countries, again, not all, I think that explains a lot of what we're seeing and also suggests that it will go on for a while. You know, we're not yet at the stage where the demographic transition is completed, except perhaps in China. We are not yet at a stage where investment rates are falling significantly, and there's still a lot of capital, of technology that can be imported and adapted. The analysis, for example, of the most efficient firms in countries like India and China compared to the least efficient firms, there are huge gaps. So if the average Indian firm or Chinese firm looks more like its most efficient sister, right there you have a huge amount of potential for further growth. It won't last forever, obviously, but for the next two or three decades, I think we can expect this convergence or this unification, in the way François called it, to continue. So I think I just wanted to add these three basic points, which I think are some of, at least explains a good part of the phenomenon. Now, François also very much focused on the inequality within countries. And inequality can be measured in various ways, of course. The Gini coefficient is one way, the top 10 to bottom 10 ratio is another, the concentration at the top 1% is another. And I think when we talk about convergence and income distribution worldwide, as François did, and again, I fully agree with him, I think one has to bring in that dimension. Giving a lecture on convergence in the world economy and on per capita incomes without talking about income distribution within countries, I think is very insufficient. He did show us the differences between countries in terms of what's happening within. The fact, for example, that in France, inequality actually is not increasing significantly, at least so far. And he showed us the really staggering U.S. numbers, particularly if you measure inequality by the concentration at the very top. I mean, there the U.S. is, I think, beating all historical records in terms of how much income is concentrated at the top 1% or the top 0.1%. I'm not a political scientist. There are political scientists in this room. I hope somebody can explain to me that given that fact, given the top 1% or the top 0.1% making gains that are unprecedented in history, why the political system is such that tax breaks for those people are considered okay. I mean, you know, that is the topic of the town, I guess, these days. But, I mean, I just don't understand it. I just simply cannot understand how politically, you know, this is working. But it is, somehow. It is. So, I mean, obviously there's something here I'm missing. But the point I'd like to make here is that, you know, trying to explain the within country inequality to me is more difficult than explaining what's happening across countries. Because across countries, the factors I talked about, you know, the growth models, technology diffusion, demographics, savings rates, investment rates, I think explain quite a bit of the story. Why is it that in some country like the U.S., income inequality is rising, you know, at a rapid pace, whereas in another country like France, it isn't. I mean, they're more or less, they live in the same world economy. Many people say that it's technology that's driving income inequality. Well, France and U.S. have access pretty much to the same technology. I mean, you know, there's FDI, there's U.S. firms in France, there's French investment in the U.S. So, I mean, technology cannot explain why, you know, France is so different from the U.S., okay? Globalization, trade, well, again, pretty much if you look at the trade regime of the U.S. and France, it's not that different. Tariff rates, you know, protection vis-a-vis in exports from China or from India or from Bangladesh or from Turkey are not that different. So, so there's something else that makes the U.S. and France very different, or in the past that made Sweden and the U.S. very different. François showed us that Sweden has also become a lot more unequal, but when you compare the actual levels of inequality in Sweden to those in the U.S. or in the U.K., of course, Sweden remains a much, much more equal society, okay? So there's something else here which, you know, which is driving within-country inequality, which I think economists are having a big trouble explaining. And I'm going to stop there because I don't really have the explanation, but I suspect it has a lot to do with governance, with politics, with bargaining power, with things that economists actually traditionally don't look at very seriously and you know, which are not really part of their discipline, but which I think in the case of income distribution actually have a big impact. But thank you again, François, for this wonderful lecture.
We're just going to mic ourselves up here, but please prepare your questions. And as François and Kamal are getting their microphones on, I'd just like to thank both of them again for what I think were very clear presentations. For the non-economists in the room, I'm sure we're all extremely grateful. I mean, there are quite a few economists in here, but I know there are quite a few others who are not. And I was struck really by the clarity as well as the candour of the remarks here. As we do have a number of people in the audience, including Brookings colleagues who work on these issues, I'd like to turn right away to a few questions. Perhaps I can take three. This lady here. And then I'll ask Kamal and François to offer some thoughts. We have to finish promptly at 7. So if this gentleman here, right beside you, and then there's
thank
a lady
you very
here,
much.
And a gentleman at the back.
Thank you both for your presentations and response. The graphs, way over my head. Take-home message for me is that countries are beginning to divide within themselves poverty, wealth, and also competing with one another to become richer and richer. And I think the United States is the world's role model and has been and probably will continue to be. So I don't want to be a cynic, but don't you see a trend, a continuing trend, of other nations of the world looking at U.S. as the model to create that 0.1 structure and marginalize more those people who are not able to contribute to that? The second part of the question, you mentioned IMF. I was always praying for the Bretton Woods institutions to reform themselves in the face of the trends that are so clear in the world. Are they? Will they? Is there a role? I mean, where are the institutions that can make this happen? It seems they've all been pretty much suppressed.
Thank you. And this lady just in the second row behind. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. My name is Jo Marie Griesgraber. I'm with New Rules for Global Finance. And I guess I'm wondering about the governance, the global governance dimension. Maybe I came in a couple minutes late. Maybe I missed it. But there's clearly a need for it, but I didn't hear any suggestions on what to do about it. And also with regard to sub-Saharan Africa, I'd like to maybe posit a third policy in addition to trade and foreign assistance, and that is keeping illicit money within the country, whether it's flight capital or the money that's secreted out under the guise of transfer pricing, and it goes through the tax havens and ends up in London and New York, or as carry trade or returns as foreign direct investment. But I think that's very much a topic of interest for a lot of non-governmental organizations and so on. And finally, a slight suggestion as to why the U.S. is the way it is and not like France or Sweden And that is definitely, I think, a political issue in that we rely very much on Locke and that everyone is an individual unto itself. And more government is not necessarily good government. In fact, less is better has been our history, or the ideology of the founding fathers, if you will, as it's been translated. It's not that I agree with it, but whereas in France it's much more a social concern, a common good, and I won't say it's the Catholic social tradition, but it's certainly not the Lockean sort of raw individualism that we see. And we also have a much larger country, but that may not be a factor.
Thank you very much. And there's a gentleman here, and sort of thank you.
Thank you very much, Matthias Matiz. I teach political economy at American University across the street at SAIS also. I have a question about the G20. The G7 was very sort of ideologically homogeneous with a clear leader, the United States. But now we have this grouping of 20 countries where there's no obvious leadership. And even though, and that's the within the beltway disease, we always think that we have the best ideas here coming from Washington. But are these countries that are so different, and there are 20 of them, ever going to be able to agree on anything? Because it seems to me they don't just have disagreements within a same model or system, but have fundamentally different worldviews. Thank you.
Thank you. Actually, there's another question here. The gentleman sitting beside you here.
Hi. Yeah. I would like to add the dimension of the location of inequality. Cities have been increasingly becoming the engines of growth, and at the bank at these days, there is quite a discussion about that. And urbanization process has been steady over the years. And Professor Bourguignon, you talked about inward-oriented strategies that sooner or later will have to be implemented by emerging economies. And I'm wondering if you think that inward development policies will have to strengthen rural development, or if you expect an increasing urbanization-led inequality reduction.
Very good, thank you. And the gentleman at the far end here will just turn back to the panel again. Thank you.
My name is Suruma. I'm from the Uganda Africa Growth Institute here initiative. I come from a country that was declining in GDP growth in the 70s and early 80s. And has now been growing consistently in the last 20 years or so at a rate of more than 6%. And I believe that the main difference between the previous 20 years and most recent 20 years is that Uganda has been politically stable. Mm-hmm. And my concern is that, yes, I agree that aid is important for sub-Saharan Africa, but the right aid is critical, because if Uganda could continue to receive aid but was not stable, it probably wouldn't have made much difference. So I see that governance and political stability in Africa today is probably the area where aid is most needed, and not so much in other areas, because if stability can be increased, then probably growth is very likely to follow. I would like your comment on that. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Those are great comments. I'll turn back to the panel and we'll take a couple more when you've got a chance to remarks. François.
Should I start? Okay, fine. Thank you very much for this comment, and thanks to Kemal. I'm sorry that we agreed too much, but I should say that Kemal was in Paris School of Economics 2 weeks ago, and we had more or less exactly the opposite kind of dialogue. So... it was not exactly the same presentation. We didn't have the same slides. Okay, a couple of reactions to Kemal's comments and some of the remarks which have been made. First, in the explanation of growth in emerging countries, I couldn't agree with the three factors that Kemal mentioned. But I would say that the globalization process itself helped a lot. I mean, the fact that suddenly you have markets in the world, which are big markets, where there is no limit to how much you can produce, has certainly been a, been, certainly been a big advantage for these countries. This is not the first time. I mean, you could say that the development of Taiwan, the development of Korea at the beginning was also very much helped by the fact that the American market was open to them. But I would not discard this kind of explanation. In the this issue of the big inequality in the U.S., why it is not the case that we have the same thing in France, and what it seems to be abnormal in the case of the U.S. I'm not convinced that everything is really country-specific. I would say that there is some elements of globalization behind that. It is very surprising that, for example, when you look at low-level wage workers, it might be the case that in European countries where you have a minimum wage, the competition coming from the rest of the world is being transformed into more unemployment. And because unemployment is rather generously insured, then the impact on the distribution is not that big. Whereas in the U.S., the impact is directly on the level of wages, and this is the reason why we have such a low increase in low wages in the U.S. The cause may be the same. It may be foreign competition, but the effect is not the same because labor markets do not function in the same way. This has been very much, this is what I was saying, this has been very much debated back in the end of the 90s, and suddenly it disappeared from the radar screen. And lately there was a paper by Paul Krugman, who was the author of a paper in the 90s saying, finally, it is not really globalization and trade with South countries that is causing this low increase in low wages in the U.S. It is more technical progress than trade, but this already was raising an issue. To what extent is technical progress the result of globalization and trade and the competition that comes with globalization? So I never believed completely this kind of argument. But what I find quite interesting is that in a recent paper, I think it is a 2008 paper, Krugman says, if I have to repeat the same exercise as I did in 1995, then I would find a much bigger impact of globalization on the distribution in the U.S. Now, this is at the bottom of the distribution. At the top of the distribution, there may be something which is idiosyncratic in the case of the U.S., but what I observe is the fact that globalization, again, is spreading in the world what is going on in the U.S. I mean, it's very difficult to imagine that a French executive, a French CEO, would be paid at a rate which would be much, much lower than U.S. CEOs, simply because you have the same people sitting in the boards. They are exchanging views. All those, many of those companies are multinationals, and it is through the multinational that you have this big increase in the payment of CEOs, and then this is spreading in all the world. So, and this is exactly what we are what we are observing today in France. And this recent book by Atkinson and Alvaredo and Piketty, which is called Top Incomes, is really about this and seems to suggest that this process is really a very common and almost universal process. So we might try to think about why is it the case that suddenly those people are making so much more money in the case of the U.S., but one thing which I think cannot be doubted is the fact that this is spreading to the rest of the world. And from that point of view, again, globalization is part of the story. On global governance, there were several questions about this. There is no global governance. I mean, this is what we have to recognize. I mean, there is no entity, there is no institution which we can call global governance. Very often when people start talking about global governance, At the end, they are talking about the IMF and the World Bank and the Bretton Woods institution. But it is true that those institutions can do a couple of things in which have a global implications, but their power is extraordinarily limited. So we completely agree. And the G20 is not a global governance entity. The G7 was not a global governance entity. It is only in situations where you have very serious conditions in the world, like an economic crisis back 2 years ago, that you can see suddenly the G20 or the G7 people agreeing on something and saying we will all do this and we will all do that. Now, as soon as you get out of this kind of common crisis situation, which is the case now, you have the G20 in Seoul and the previous one, which was, where was it?
Toronto.
The one in Toronto, where basically nothing has been decided. Does that mean that we should simply dismiss the G20? I don't completely agree with that. I mean, it seems to me that if there is a message that is loud and clear coming out from the G20, it will be received by people, and it will have, at the end, it will have some impact. It will be weak, it will be indirect, but this is the only thing that we have for the moment. So let's make sure that at least this entity is generating the right kind of message. On Africa, about the issue about corruption, is well taken, and this is probably because this kind of corruption you are referring to is very much linked to extractive industry, and because we know that this extractive industry initiative is not working very well, and there is no reason for this initiative to work well. I mean, it's a good thing to have countries reporting how much they've gotten from oil companies, and oil companies reporting what they have given to what they have paid to a government. Now, there is no need for the two parts to report all the side payments which have been made. So we know that this will not be working. But at the same time, we also know that one possibility or one way out of that is to make sure that those economies are diversifying and that it is possible to get some income from the rest of the world, but not only through the export of commodities. And this is certainly something very important. This ties very much with the point made by our Ugandan colleague about the right aid. And I think that we completely agree with you in the sense that aid may be effective when it is received by a country where there is a governance that is more or less satisfactory, where there is some transparency, when people, donors, not only donors, but the people in the country can see the way in which the aid money is being used. Now, when we refer to countries where we don't have this kind of governance, what is being called often fragile countries, then the situation is completely different. And so we could say that we have an aid model that works more or less well for countries with a reasonably good governance. We don't have any aid model that works well for the other countries. We're still looking for such a model. Now, where you are absolutely right is that maybe in terms of needs, the real needs are in the second type of country with not that good governance institutions, rather than in countries with good governance, with as Uganda and Tanzania and Ghana today are growing faster than others. So you're right. I mean, there is an issue there. I'm not saying that we should increase aid and give aid everywhere, and this will be doing good things. There is an issue about aid effectiveness, but we will not solve the issue of aid effectiveness by simply eliminating aid, which is what some people are more or less suggesting. I guess I've covered more or less all the questions which have been asked.
Yeah, Kamal, would you like to add something there?
Well, very quickly, since it's already 7 o'clock, but maybe there is the beginning of a slight disagreement, which is a good thing. First, I agree with the globalization. I mean, the way that technology can spread thanks to globalization, thanks to the financial system, thanks to trade, foreign direct investment, I think that's very important. But in terms of the analysis of inequality, I think when we look at the numbers, I mean, the differences are still too large. The unexplained part remains important, particularly at the top. And for example, the fact that in the U.S., the political system manages to have a 15% income tax rate on hedge fund income, you know, I don't think it has anything to do with globalization. I mean, I think there are political factors at work that I think explain at least some of that. Now, it may be spreading, and I think your point about competitiveness is very, very important here. I mean, there is the view that a strong social safety net is a factor that could undermine competitiveness, and that, of course, there are very high, you know, if tax rates reach 60-70% or whatever, that may be the case. But there's also a lot of evidence at the end of the day that countries with a very strong social safety net actually have been very competitive and have done very well. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Scandinavian countries obviously are one. Now, they're smaller and it's hard to compare. Germany has done very well with a strong social safety net. And despite the French complaining a lot, France actually hasn't done so badly. When one compares growth performance in the U.S. to Europe, and one does it in per capita terms, and one of Europe's problems is, of course, the demography, whereas the U.S. has a more dynamic demography, which is a big advantage to the U.S. But when you actually adjust it in per capita terms, the U.S. is doing a little bit better, but not a lot better than Europe, and in fact, less well than some northern European countries. So it's not necessarily true that you cannot be competitive and growing rapidly and at the same time have a strong social state. I think this has been propagandized by some people a little bit beyond the facts. And Mary Jo's point about, there was a time in the U.S. in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, in the 50s and 60s particularly, but also in the 30s and 40s, where the gains from productivity were shared very broadly, and where, in fact, income distribution was improving rapidly and significantly. So it historically, when we look at the last 7-8 decades in the U.S., it's really the most recent 2 or 3 decades that, you know, show this divergence. It's not a characteristic of the U.S. that has always been there. And so, I think it's quite disconcerting, because then what explains it? And there, unfortunately, my wisdom kind of ends. I guess our time ends too.
Yes, well, Kamal, you've obviously set the scene for another panel. And in fact, the Center on the U.S. and Europe does indeed plan, with the help of our colleague Justin Vaïs, who is also, I'm pleased to say, helpfully sponsored by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. We're planning sometime in the next few months a discussion about some of these issues, about governance and some of the divergent and also convergent trends in Europe and the United States. And we hope that perhaps many of you here will be able to join us for that, as well as François and Kamal, and we'll keep you all posted. I'm sorry that I have to cut off the time. We have to be economical with something these days. And we also, many of you here in the audience have other things to do, and we also don't want to drain François of too much of his resources after he's done this grueling trip, escaping from the winter snows of Paris. I'd like to thank all of you for joining us tonight, and Kamal and François for a great lecture.